The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are in central London, just outside, or just a little bit along from our new home venue, Vermouteria, the Vermouth themed cycling themed cafe in Coles Yard, not far from King's Cross Station.
Happy with that pronunciation, Daniel Freib.
Yeah, they're all the rage, aren't they?
Vermouth
bars. Yeah, there are lots of them in Mallorca and Berlin, actually.
Well, lots. Do you have a favourite vermouth, Daniel?
No, I'm not really into it. I don't really understand it, napalm. I keep meaning to actually do a bit of research and find out, you know, what it's all about. When you drink it, what you drink it with, and what are the faux pas, what are the big social faux pas to avoid, which obviously is always a big topic with me. I'm not prepared to discuss it until I become a vermouth snob.
Oh, brilliant.
That's a principle by which Daniel has lived very well so far. So yeah. Good luck with that. Welcome back, Lionel.
Oh, thank you.
Are you feeling better?
Week off. Getting there, yeah, getting there.
You had a week off, did you? Well, I've got a week off now.
I've got a week. I did have a week off for my week off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, welcome back. Now. You're looking well in the London sunshine.
What was wrong, Daniel?
I had a week off.
Oh.
A cough. A cough, cold, just laid low. In the parlance of professional cyclists, I had a viral infection and I was off the bike.
The sensations were not good, were they?
The sensations were terrible. You know, it didn't start any of the stages last week, basically.
I was with you, Daniel. I should open this week's episode by apologising for the noise in last week's episode of the road. I got the recording levels a bit wrong. So I do apologise for that. But I hope it added to the atmosphere.
Oh, it was wonderful. From my sick bed, listening to you guys on a Mallorcan roundabout during rush hour was just a treat.
It wasn't actually that busy. It was entirely my fault. I was using Daniel's recorder, which is exactly the same as mine, but for some reason felt unable to adjust the recording levels. So, sorry, everybody.
Yeah, it's like riding somebody else's bike, isn't it? The sensations weren't good.
The sensations weren't good. However, the sensations were good, obviously, podcasting with you in Mallorca, Daniel, and back now in London. In this week's episode, we're going to hear from TJ Van Garderen, who has made his debut for Education First, and it's looking pretty good, a new start for him. And we're going to hear from Sepp van Marck, that same team's classic specialist, as we look ahead to Het Nieuwsblad at the weekend. And Lionel, you're heading out there. That's the season proper for you, isn't it?
Yes, it is, really. And I don't want to totally discount everything we've talked about since the start of January, but it does feel like the proper beginning of the season to me, anyway. But then, you know, I'm old school.
You certainly are. You certainly are. Well, we'll hear from those two. We've got a few other things to talk about as well. But can you give us a news roundup, please?
I can. Yet again, another bumper week of news. First of all, Rich, sorry, I did provide some notes for last week's news roundup, which
inserted
which
a couple of errors in there.
I did insert a couple of errors for you that you didn't fact check.
You sent me them 5 minutes before we started recording.
Well, I was in a feverish state, Rich. You know, the temperature was very high. Accuracy dipped to sort of 58-59%, I think. But the one kind of grey area in the news roundup was regarding the Belgian rider who had a hip replacement, rides for Wanty Groupe
Bart
Gobert. Bart de Klerk, that's right. And the team and de Klerk himself said he's the first pro to have a hip replacement. I meant to insert in the notes just Floyd Landis ? Because we know Floyd Landis had first a hip resurfacing and then he did have a full hip replacement.
Which is what Andy Murray has just had.
Yeah, and there's a difference, isn't there? Because you've had your hip replaced, of course.
I have.
So
full replacement. My hip surgeon is a podcast listener, Marcus Banks, if you're listening. You will be.
Great.
Very good. Very good man.
Anyone
looking for a hip replacement, he is your man.
But Landis had his hip replaced and then did return to racing of some kind at some level, basically.
Yeah.
So happy to clear that up. Anyway, the racing, loads of racing. The Tour of Oman concluded. Astana's Alexei Lutsenko wrapped up his second consecutive victory there for Astana. Astana's run continued at the Ruta del Sol with Jakob Fuglsang winning overall. His teammates Jon Izagirre and Pello Bilbao were second and fourth, with Steven Kruiswijk of Jumbo-Visma in third place. Tim Wellens, who's been in good form this season so far, won a couple of stages, including the time trial. And Matteo Trentin of Mitchelton Scott won a couple of stages as well. But probably the outstanding performance, individual performance of the week, was Simon Yates' solo stage win into Granada. Probably talk about him a little bit once the news roundup is concluded. Just a little bit over from the Ruta del Sol, which is in southern Spain, the tour, the Volta ao Algarve, in southern Portugal, won by 20-year-old Slovenian Tadej Pogacar, who won the Tour de l'Avenir, one of a number of very talented young riders, pulled off the victory with a perfectly timed stage win ahead of Wout Poels, Enric Mas and Sam Omen. Possibly benefited a little bit from a little bit of weakness in Team Sky's train. Theo Gegenhardt looked very strong, but then David de la Cruz kind of let things slip a little bit, left Wout Poels with a little bit too much to do, and Pogacar pulled off the stage win there.
And everyone's now seeing Remco who?
Exactly, yeah, that's how quickly it changes, doesn't it? But yeah,
I mean, we had a little feature on Team UAE Emirates, UAE Team Emirates, they're actually called, aren't they? In last week's podcast, if you can hear that against the drone of the buses and trucks in Palma. But we spoke to Jeroen Swart, their medical director, and got a little bit of a sense of the overhaul in the backroom team at that team.
We mentioned Martin Fernandez, didn't we? The gentleman who was responsible for scouting Pogacar, who, as you say, everyone now is predicting will be the next Eddy Merckx, the latest in a long line. But there are plenty of cautionary tales, aren't there? There are a few people posted online over the weekend, the last riders to win stage races at that kind of age or stage races of that level. Thomas Löfqvist was younger than Pogacar when he won the Circuit de la Sarthe in 2004, and his career ended up being a bit of an anticlimax, didn't it?
Boomed and bust, didn't it, really? Had that very good couple of years with HTC Colombia, not sure what they were called at the time, actually. Were they just Colombia? And then, but didn't quite work out for him at Sky, did it?
I think he too much too young, Thomas Löfqvist. He was a big trainer, I think.
I know I saw the tweets you're talking about. I mean, there aren't many 20-year-olds. Bernardo Ruiz was 20 years old when he won the Tour of Catalonia in 1945. It's a long time since somebody that young has won a stage race of that level. Wilco Kelderman won the Tour of Norway in 2011, but it was not quite the same category of race. So a real standout achievement. And he looks good. I mean,
Well, the cycling media can heap the expectation on Pogacar's shoulders like a game of buckaroo. And
I think,
Daniel,
you might have called him Pogacar, did you there, around Pogacar?
Pogacar?
I know Slovenian is not your strong point, so I'm hoping for the emergence
of nailed, lots of I did in last
talented
week,
Slovenian riders.
In the last week, I have nailed the pronunciation of his first name. It's like the word today in Cockney. Today. I looked it up.
Is it?
Today. Yeah, it is. Okay. The stress on the first syllable.
Today Pogacar.
Yep.
Well, anyway, it's probably a name we're going to be saying a lot.
Indeed. Helicopter went over a couple of minutes ago. That
was like a bike race was approaching,
TV,
wasn't it?
Are we live now on TV? Anyway, sticking with Algarve, De Koenig won the first and last stages with Fabio Jakobsen and Zdenek Stibar. Stefan Kung of Groupama FDJ won the time trial, and Dylan Groenewegen of Jumbo-Visma won the other sprint stage. At the Tour du Haut-Var, a three-day stage race in the south of France, as it is now. It used to be a one-day race, then a two-day race, now a three-day race. By about 2050, it'll be as long as the Tour de France at this rate. Thibaut Pinot won after winning the final stage on Montferrand, the famous climb that climbs above Toulon. The other stages were won by EF Education first Sepp van Marck, who we'll hear from a bit later on, and Trek Segafredo's Giulio Ciccone. Pinot won overall ahead of Bardet and EF's British rider Hugh Carthy. More Astana success with a stage win for Mahari Kudus at the Tour of Rwanda. And the World Tour resumed with the UAE Tour, which is the first edition of a merger between the Abu Dhabi and Dubai Tours. A few days in now, Jumbo-Visma won the team time trial. Perhaps some signs of that progress in your friend's special, Rich, hearing about how they have worked as a group. Fernando Gaviria won the first sprint stage, and Alejandro Valverde got his first victory in the rainbow jersey at Jebel Hafit. He also won there in the Abu Dhabi Tour last year. As we speak, Primoz Roglic is leading overall, still a few days to go in the UAE Tour, so not done yet. There's a women's stage race in southern Spain, the Setmana Valencia, only ranked 2.2, but as there aren't so many four-day women's stage races worth a mention, in fact, in the World Tour, only the Giro Rosa, the Women's Tour and the Holland Tour are longer. Anyway, the race was won by Clara Koppenberg of Germany. Finland's Lotta Lepisto won two stages there.
Worth mentioning, Koppenberg rides for WNT, a team that's really stepped up this year. Lisa Brenner and Kirsten Wild have joined that team. They've been around for a few years, but nobody's really talked about them, but they look set to be quite a force, and that was an incredible ride by Koppenberg, a real talent.
Away from the racing, it's been confirmed that the 2021 Tour de France will start in Copenhagen, capital of Denmark. Second Grand Tour start for Denmark after the 2012 Giro started in Bjarne Riis's hometown, Herning. Looking forward to a weekend in Denmark. There'll be three
start
stages.
Saving.
And then a rest day slash transfer back to France, which is a slight departure for the Tour. The Giro has certainly sort of, trademarked almost this big start that then has a transfer day back to the host countries. Team Sky's rider Ben Swift is out of hospital after spending a few days in intensive care after a pretty nasty training crash in Tenerife where he was riding with Geraint Thomas. He ruptured his spleen. Unsure at the moment when he'll be back in racing. British cyclocross champion, 10-time British cyclocross champion Helen Wyman has retired. She was also twice European champion and World Championship bronze medalist. And Belgian rider Victor Campenaerts has confirmed that his hour record attempt will be in April the 16th or 17th in Mexico at altitude. The women's hour record was set there by Vittoria Bussi of Italy last September. Campenaerts of Lotto Sudal needs to beat 54.526 kilometres. That's Bradley Wiggins' record. And what's the feeling? Is he going to
do it?
Well,
we heard from him, didn't we? A few weeks ago, Daniel spoke to him about his our record ambitions. Is this a bit earlier than we expected, Daniel?
Around about the time when he was thinking of doing it, I was slightly struck when I spoke to him in Mallorca by the, I wouldn't say haphazard nature of his planning, but certainly it seemed fairly, well, less kind of assiduous and forensic than Bradley Wiggins had been or was in 2000. Was it 2014? I had a bit of a mental block earlier today. I was trying to think. I can't remember if I was actually at that hour record.
I think I was,
but I have no recollection of it whatsoever.
I think we've all blanked out because it was a very stressful occasion for us, wasn't it?
We did a live podcast from the Track Central, if you remember, Daniel, and we only just got on air with about a minute to go. We were the second most shambolic broadcaster on that day because Sky, who was showing it live, missed the start. They were on the adverts when Wiggins actually pushed off and then just had 59 minutes and 40 seconds
action. I can't really remember now. How on earth did we commentate or broadcast on an hour record for an hour? How do we keep
the
that
evidence
going?
Is there if you want to go back and listen
God,
to it.
No.
Furrowed brow and head in hands.
I think it's an event best followed on teletext, isn't it? But can he do it? I mean, I refer to his preparation then. I mean, what really struck me was when he talked about his bike for the hour record. And he said, well, there's no special bike. We've not done any real work on that. Ridley have got a good track bike and that's what I'm using. Which, as I say, was certainly in contrast to my recollection of the kind of hype and preparation that went into the Wiggins record attempt. Also, the pedigrees of the various riders that have attempted it. Wiggins certainly had a more impressive palmarès than Campenaerts currently has, and Rohan Dennis certainly has more or better credentials as a time trialist than Campenaerts has, although Campenaerts is himself a very good time trialist. So I'm not sure. I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, there are other riders and a couple of Danish riders who have attempted it over the last couple of years who have surprised me with how close they've got to the hour record. I refreshed my memory the other day. I was reading Thomas Dekker's book, The Descent, which I would highly recommend. It's a fantastic book, a sort of doping memoir. But he also talks about his hour record attempt. He had a go when his career was pretty much over on the road. And he wasn't that far away at the time. The bar has been raised slightly since then. But Thomas Dekker at that point was pretty much washed up as a road rider. And Campenaerts is in his peak years, so
and he, I mean unconventional is the word that springs to mind in his approach. He's been training in Namibia as well, and I noticed he complained about having not been drug tested while he's been out there. He was surprised that he hadn't been drug tested, which no matter where people are training, you would hope that they would be drug tested, especially if they're going for something like their record. But for all that his preparation might not be quite as meticulous as Wiggins, he will have the advantage of the thin air in Mexico, but he'll be acclimatized to that.
Yeah, he will, Rich, but there's a payoff to that, isn't there? Because it's obviously, it's a difficult equation. If you listen to people who have attempted the hour record or thought about attempting it at altitude, then obviously you go through the air quicker, but it's harder to breathe and take in oxygen. So and I think most people think that the benefits outweigh the disadvantages there.
Finish up with the news. A few little other bits. The tramadol ban comes into effect this weekend. Omloop Nieuwsblad will be the first race where tramadol is completely banned. And a little story in Het Nieuwsblad, the newspaper, the Belgian newspaper from the UCI, they're beefing up the fines for littering and throwing bidons, water bottles. A 1,000 Swiss francs fine, roughly £750. Slightly strange story. This is sort of one of those throwaway remarks that's been extrapolated out into a news story, it felt to me, because I don't really see how the regulation has changed. Remember, green zones were introduced in about 2014, I think. These are the areas where riders can drop their litter with impunity and it will be cleaned up after them. It seems that the two things that the UCI want to clamp down on are littering, obviously, which is, there's really no excuse for it, certainly when it comes to the gel wrappers that could just be put back in the pocket. And that's important, I think, because it sets an example for general cyclists, sportive riders, people just out riding their bikes to take their litter home. Really, no excuse for dropping it on the side of the road anyway, whether you're competing or not. But the bidon issue is a trickier one, because we see riders throwing them away sometimes in what looks like quite a reckless fashion, big high arc, but the priority is not to throw them onto the road so that they cause other riders danger. The idea is to try and clear the road and get them into the hedgerow, but I think from a sort of the optics of it are not great, the look of the peloton riding along throwing bottles away. The irony is they want to not have bottles being thrown near spectators where there could be a danger, but if they are thrown where spectators are, then the fans will run and gather them as souvenirs. So it's a kind of a strange one, and it's one of these, until you see how the rule has been written, it's going to be interesting to see how they discriminate between who does get a fine and who doesn't get a fine, what will be the circumstances. It's gloriously unclear, as some of these UCI missives seem to be, but that will come into effect this weekend. Finally, the World Track Championships get underway in Pruszków in Poland. Richard, were you there in 2009?
Yeah,
it was a good one, wasn't it? I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it was. So we'll keep an eye on that. It's one of the stories that will probably get quite a lot of traction in the UK is the return of Victoria Williamson, who broke her neck, back and pelvis in January 2016 at the Rotterdam Six Day in a very bad crash. She made her comeback at the Hong Kong World Cup this January. She returned to the World Championships and will do the sprint and 500 metres. Quite a lot of stuff about her comeback on the BBC's website, which
and
is worth
about
a look.
Her injuries on the second podcast, Femina, a couple of years ago. We had a long interview with her, and it was remarkable. Her determination was remarkable. It's been a long, much longer journey than she anticipated.
And as I said, it's the opening weekend in Belgium, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and Kerner Brussels Kerner. And 20 years since I first covered a professional bike race, Rich. Can you believe it? I mean, don't look a day over 60.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa, and the latest installment of the Gone Racing, their series of behind-the-scenes films with EF Education First, has just gone up. It's from the Tour Colombia, the Tour of Colombia, I want to call it, and it's mainly a focus on Rigoberto Urán, their sort of talisman, a hugely popular figure in Colombia, and that certainly comes across in the film. There wasn't a lot of TV coverage, or it wasn't easy to watch the Tour of Colombia, so it's a nice little flavour of what it was like and what the atmosphere was like and the Colombian fans and so on. So that's highly recommended. Go to rafa.cc or you'll find it on the Rafa channel on YouTube. That's the latest Gone Racing episode. What caught your eye then in all the recent racing that we've just heard about? I mean, an obvious one in Pogacar, we talked about him. A few riders catching my eye. David Godu in UAE rode extremely well. He was the only guy I could go with Roglic initially. Jumbo Visma have been very impressive there as well so far. Roglic looks strong. But David Godu... Daniel.
Joel, just on teams as well, Rich. I know we keep referring to it, but Astana's run of form. So they've had 13 victories to date. And the most extraordinary thing I think about this run is that none of those have been in sprint stages. Usually when teams rack up a lot of wins, there's a sprinter somewhere in there who's rattling off three or four. And the number of general classification victories they've had in stage races to date is just staggering. I mean, they won Valencia, they won Murcia, they won Colombia, Tour La Provence, Ruta del Sol with Fuglsang, Oman with Lutsenko, and they're well placed as well with Kudus to win the Tour of Rwanda.
The question, everybody is asking is, to what extent do we credit the Astana rap? I mean, how much has that been a factor, do you think, in this incredible run? It has been building for a while, I have to say. I mean, Astana, it was interesting because going into last season, they'd lost Fabio Aru, they'd lost Vincenzo Nibali, and it looked like they'd had their head cut off to some extent. You wondered where these wins were going to come from. And then, if you remember exactly a year ago, there were questions about payments. Salaries had not been paid. There was uncertainty over the future of the team. Michael Valgren won Het Nieuwsblad, and that was all he was asked about. But around that time, you got the sense that the team was sort of galvanized, and these guys who'd always been capable of great performances, like Valgren, started delivering. And it's just really carried on from there.
And it got me thinking, Rich, as well about this period of the season. And we've spoken in the last couple of weeks about Tim Wellens. I was very tickled by, I can't remember who it was that tweeted at the weekend about the threat that global warming poses to Tim Wellens and his career, because he seems to thrive at this time of year when it's particularly when it tends to be quite cool. But there are so many stage races at this time of year. And, you know, later in the episode, I think we're going to talk about TJ Van Garderen. And sometimes when we think about stage races, we think in terms of, well, are they going to do GC or are they going to go for stages? Or possibly at a stretch, you know, they could start focusing on one-week stage races instead. But actually, you know, there's such variety at this time of year to rack up, not easy wins, but there are a lot of opportunities to win 3-day races, 4-day races, 5-day races. There's really something there for everyone in the sort of galaxy of stage race riders, and that's really what Astana have done. I mean, they've won with a variety of different riders in a variety of different ways, relying on their time trialing ability, their climbing ability, over 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, and taking a lot of pressure off themselves for the rest of the season,
because frankly they're not going to win a Grand Tour. They're not, you know, they don't have somebody at, I forgot about Lopez. Gee whiz, I forgot about Lopez. They could well win a Grand Tour. He's the one guy though that's capable of that. You know, the rest of them are
as you say, capable of winning at the level that they're winning at the moment.
I think the interesting thing is that certain riders seem to be winning, specialising almost in this time of the season, or winning in the same places or similar places. Sort of streaks, even Valverde winning on the same climb in the Middle East. There's quite a bit of this going on. Tim Wellens has won in the same place in Mallorca. I think he's won in the Ruta del Sol before as well.
He won Ruta del Sol last year.
That's right, yeah. So there's kind of riders who are obviously got their focus on this part of the season. But you say, Daniel, it takes the pressure off, and to a degree it does. But it soon gets forgotten, doesn't it? When the bigger races start coming, the classics and then into the Giro, these wins kind of, they have greater importance now while they're current, obviously. And they do put a little bit of money in the bank, so to speak, but they don't rack up a great deal of interest people aren't interested in them, but Astana's spring streak can soon turn round on them, and if they don't win anything in the classics or the Grand Tours, the question will be, well, how come they were so good in the spring when it didn't matter, and now they're going like a
bag of
spuds.
That's true, Napalm. I would say from an egotistical point of view, from an individual rider's point of view, there's very good reason to come into the season pretty hot and target some of these races, because we've seen it in the last few years, and particularly last year, with uncertainty about, it only takes one sponsor or a couple of sponsors in the World Tour, there ends up being a bit of a mad dash in August and September to get a contract. And if you can start racking up results early in the year and you're in a position to sign a deal or shop yourself around in May and June, there's a massive advantage to that. So those guys, the ones of them that are out of contract at the end of the year, the guys who have already racked up good results in these races in February have very much enhanced their market value.
And of course, there's a lot to be said for just getting out on the front foot, racing and trying to win, as we saw with Simon Yates at the Ruta del Sol. I mean, you can't be churlish about it. We want to see the best riders giving it some welly whenever they get they get on the start line, and to see particularly the way Yates raced. I mean, the day that was kind of false flat that Trentin won, where he was riding on the front with a couple of teammates. I mean, clearly working training, but also then when the road went upwards and he had the opportunity to get away, he got up the road on his own. So kind of a double edge to it, preparing for the bigger events to come, but also just rediscovering the sensations of winning.
Yeah, and Simon Yates, as well as catching the eye with his performance, caught the eye with an interview that he gave in the Spanish press, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, Rich. Some very eye-catching quotes from that, particularly about the Tour de France and his lack of interest for the Tour de France. We know that he's not, well, he doesn't plan to do the Tour de France this year, or it's certainly not going to be a priority. He might roll out of the Giro and end up starting the Tour, but the Giro is his number one priority. And he said to a Spanish website, Ciclo21.com, that he really doesn't feel very enthusiastic about the Tour at all. It's just another race for him, and he gets much more excited about the Giro and the Vuelta. He was hinting, he didn't go into a lot of detail about why this was. It's more of a sort of emotional, a visceral thing, but he was sort of hinting that the route itself tends to be much less exciting in the Tour, certainly from his point of view, and also just everything that goes with the Tour, the hype, the sort of media presence, which he doesn't particularly relish, and he feels that at the Giro and the Vuelta, it's much more about the bike racing, and that sort of tallies with what we see from Simon Yates. He's someone who I think is his biggest asset, really, is his ability to sort of zone in and focus on racing, and it's much easier to do that at the Giro and the Vuelta. There's less pressure, there's less attention, but yeah, I think there won't be any foie gras hampers and winging their way to Simon Yates's pied-à-terre in Andorra after that interview from ASO.
I think the obligation to say that the tour is the most appealing thing to you in the season, I mean, doesn't he should feel no obligation to say that. If he prefers the Giro and the Vuelta and the style of racing, good on him for saying it. Because, you know, the tour is like a sort of, you know, it's a bit like a sort of business conference, isn't it? It's work. It doesn't look like there's the same opportunities to you know, express yourself as a rider. We see how much importance is placed on just those little flurries at the end of stages. You're effectively waiting and waiting and waiting for sort of 4 or 5 kilometres of racing on each given mountain stage. I know it's loosened up a little bit and teams have tried things. Lotto Jumbo last year notably really went all out on the Alpe d'Huez stage, but it didn't work, and there are very good reasons why it doesn't work. Whereas in the Giro and the Vuelta, there is a more freedom and more opportunity to make things exciting. And if it's exciting for people to watch, it's more exciting for the riders, I'm sure. You know, being away up the road, making the race happen, putting people under pressure behind, got to be more exciting than sitting in a group of 20 that becomes 18, that becomes 16 and 12 and then 5 and then going pop. You know, it is more dynamic racing often.
And just finally on Yates, chaps, do I have permission to make a fool of myself?
Always, Daniel.
I thought you might say that. Well, I was thinking about Simon Yates, and it occurred to me that of the current peloton, he is probably one of the two riders that I would be most confident of winning another Grand Tour, or winning a Grand Tour from here until the end of time. I think he's coming into his peak years and was so impressive at the Vuelta last year. Anyway, last night I got thinking about this, and I did a bit of a ranking of the likelihood in descending order.
I think you're on your own out there in Mallorca,
riders,
aren't you, Daniel?
Riders and the likelihood of riders winning a Grand Tour between now and the end of their careers. Do you want to hear it? I got to number 18.
Of course.
I got to number 18. Right, so it goes very quickly. Dumoulin, Simon Yates, Froome, Roglic, Bernal, Mas, Superman Lopez, obviously, Geraint Thomas, Quintana, Nibali, Adam Yates, Roman Bardet, Thibaut Pinot, Richie Porte, Mikel Landa, Bob Jungels, Wilco Kelderman, Rigoberto Urán. There you go.
Where's Pogacar?
Pogacar, he's not on there. We've not seen, he's 20
he
years
be
old.
There. He should be there.
What do you think of that?
Venepoel.
What do you think of that? No. What do you think of the top five? What do you think of the top five?
Gegenhardt.
What do you think of my top five? Dumoulin, Yates,
solid.
Froome, Roglic, Bernal. Simon Yates more likely
to win. I was quite
a grand
surprised
tour
to hear
between
I was
now
quite
and the
surprised
end of time than Chris Froome.
I hope he's not listening, but I was quite surprised that Geraint Thomas was so far up there.
Yeah, ahead of Landa. You think Thomas is more likely to win a Grand Tour, another Grand Tour, than Landa is?
I would say so. I mean,
I agree with that.
Thomas has got probably 2-3 more opportunities, would you say?
Yeah, but Landa's got more opportunities.
Well, exactly. Landa's got more opportunities, but he's got nowhere near thus far. So,
thus far, correct.
Anyway, yeah. Send in your ranking. Send in your top 18, everyone.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast, team car, at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by The Economist. The Economist newspaper is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, the arts, the environment, and even sport. The Economist sifts through the noise, focusing on the essential information that tells the real story in a time when facts matter more than ever. And it's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. Now, that's almost a dictionary definition of you, Rich. Oh,
very good. Very good, Lionel.
What have you been reading in The Economist this week?
Well, the article that caught my eye this week, Lionel, was towards the back of the magazine. It's the Johnson column, What We Talk About When We Talk. Less language than you might think is devoted to conveying information. Obviously not when it comes to the news roundup and the cycling podcast. It takes as a starting point a big focus in the New Yorker magazine on the novelist Dan Mallory and his relationship with the truth, which is a fascinating piece to read. But it looks at just how language is more slippery than we might assume, and how little of it is actually about conveying information and facts. again, which is contrary to what we might assume. Talks about a study at Stanford University looking at 1,000 five-minute conversations between strangers and how little of that conversation is about conveying facts and information. Only 36%, in fact. The rest of it is all just agreeing, acknowledging, or appreciating what the other person is saying. And I thought this was really interesting. It kind of confirms things that we maybe think that we know, but explains them in a very clear and quite thought-provoking way. A solution to this, the article suggests at the end, is for everyone to realize how much language is non-propositional, and in the course of a conversation to constantly say to whoever you're speaking to, are you expressing yourself or proposing a fact?
This could revolutionize a cycling podcast, couldn't
well,
it? This
may not make for charming conversation, as the article says, but it may prevent misunderstandings.
Right. Well, we have corrections corner in the event of misunderstandings, don't we? So, well, if you want to get a free print copy of The Economist delivered to you and you're in the UK, you can text the word cycling to 78070. That's cycling to 78070.
Well, Daniel, I'm still digesting your list, which you delivered in rapid fire there, and there wasn't really time.
I did not want to write that down and post it on the internet.
I'm going to transcribe it.
Someone will write it down.
I think the problem with your list, Daniel, is that the flaw is that it's solely focused on past performance predicting future events, and as we know from cycling, somebody will come along and make a mockery and ride a coach and horses through your list.
But that's how probability works, Lionel. it's a very basic concept. I know you've been ill, but it's not that difficult to understand.
He can really only go on the evidence that there is rather than the evidence that doesn't exist yet. So, you know, there'll be other people alive who will win Grand Tours, but they might not even have ridden a bike yet.
Somebody, there'll be the next Pogacar will come along and
could be Maxime Moore, who knows? I don't know. Anyway, one person who wasn't on your list, Daniel, was TJ Van Garderen.
No, although TJ Van Garderen, it always shocks me to realise how young TJ Van Garderen still is.
23.
He's 30.
Yeah, I was joking. He is.
Last August.
He's been around for a while, and he has embarked on a fresh chapter this year with EF Education First after several years at BMC. I think it'll be interesting to see how he gets on, because as we've talked about a lot, BMC was a team with quite a rigid sort of hierarchy and a system of riding, and EF Education First is certainly a team where there's maybe a bit more room for individuality and maybe a bit less pressure as well. So we dispatched our man Tom Wally, our ace producer, and you may recognise Tom's voice from the Explore series of podcasts as well. But Tom went to the EF Education First training camp in Girona last week and did a few interviews for us, and spoke to TJ Van Garderen about rebooting his career and about that kind of eternal conflict between riding for GC and riding for stages and where he stands on that.
This team, obviously, you're new here. It seems like, judging from speaking to other riders and hearing interviews and stuff, it seems like quite a free-spirited team, sort of embraces the idiosyncrasies of the riders. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. There's definitely, riders are encouraged to express their identities and kind of just have an identity and, you know, be themselves. And yeah, I think that's great.
Does that suit you as a rider?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm as out there as some of the other guys with the mullets and mustaches and everything. But yeah, I definitely feel like I'm free to be myself and express myself here.
We were talking about the team and the sort of the free-spiritedness. Obviously, they've got this alternative race calendar that's sort of cropped up, been talked about. Is that anything that you're going to be a part of? Have you got other eyes on other types of races that you might want to do?
It's not on my calendar as of right now, but the one that that I think would be cool would be the Leadville 100, because it's after the tour, so it doesn't interfere with any sort of preparation in that regard. And, you know, I live right close to Aspen, so it's just over the hill from where I live. So I'd go home and have good fitness from the tour. So it'd be a fun race to kind of hop into.
So you've mentioned the tour then. Is that the tour is on your program for this year then?
As of now, yes. Obviously, getting closer to the event, anything can change. You have to be showing good form at the time, and you know, a lot can happen from now till July. But the season's planned as if I'm doing the tour. Yeah.
And at this new team, what's your role here? You're going to be the team leader for stage races. How do you define your role here?
I mean, right now I'm more focused on just getting into the races and, you know, getting some results and getting to know the guys and getting my legs back underneath me. As far as roles go and leaderships and, you know, this team has its established leaders for the classics and obviously Rigo for the tour. So we'll just see where I slot in based on how the year is going.
Does GC still motivate you? Well, I mean, after I remember you, when you won that stage in the Giro, you seemed completely rejuvenated and maybe changed to a more of a stage hunting.
No, GC still motivates me.
Does it?
It's not that stage hunting, it's not that stage wins don't inspire me, but how you have to race in order to be stage hunting doesn't inspire me. Because you can hop in one of those breakaways and, you know, if you win the stage, you put your arms in the air, it's an amazing feeling. But those other 20 days of the race, when you don't make the breakaway and you're in the gruppetto and your mind's kind of switched off and you're just kind of slugging to the line, it makes the race really, really long. So I'd rather be fighting every day and mentally engaged on a day-to-day basis. Otherwise, it's just the suffering that you have to go through just to get to the line and finish it day by day. It's not a very fun way to race.
That's interesting to hear that, because after you won that stage, a lot of the commentators just interpreted it as, you know, you're completely reborn. This was what you were going to do for the rest of your career. It's not the case at all.
No, I mean, it's one of those things where if something happens and GC falls away, then you have to, in your mind, stay motivated and say, okay, now this is the new goal. And once that happens, then you have an opportunity to go for stage wins. But to say, like, I am no longer focusing on GC at all, screw GC, like, no, not at all. Not at all. I think, it's like I said. I've had grand tours where, you know, GC has fallen away, and I've tried to stage hunt, and it's a feeling like none other when you can actually win that stage the way I did in the Giro. But those other 20 days, man, they're no fun when you're not really engaged on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, interesting stuff from Van Garderen there, and sort of echoes what I was trying to say about Simon Yates enjoying the Giro and the Vuelta more, in the sense that if you're riding for GC, particularly in the Tour, there's an awful lot of very difficult waiting around, hard yards to race. But the thing about that is that the focus is always on, whereas, you know, if you can just loosen the reins and just go for some stage wins, lots of days will lose all definition entirely. So it's horses for courses, isn't it?
Yeah, that did strike me as the point of view, Lionel, of someone who's never had to really work as a domestique, though. As soon as I heard him say that you just don't focus on the other days. Well, you know, there are riders in the peloton who go after stage wins and then do a job for their teammates on other days.
Yeah, it's true, and I guess it depends what team you're in and whether you have a rider who's going to need that sort of support day in, day out. But I could complete, and it boils down to personality types as well, doesn't it? And I, you know, I can imagine somebody finding, you know, we often sneer a little bit, you know, in a good-natured way about riders who ride a la Zubeldia into 7th, 8th, 9th overall in GC, and wonder what the point is. But from a personal sort of satisfaction point of view, I can imagine that riding like that and feeling that you're ticking off the days and doing everything that you can and
hard would intense, but without
but sort of fulfilling as well. You know, you always have a focus, don't you?
Always have a focus, yeah. And again, I think the thing not to misunderstand about our light-hearted joke about riding Ala Zubeldia is it's not easy. You know, that's the difference, isn't it? You know, particularly in the Tour, I think riders get sort of kettled into that way of riding because finishing seventh or eighth in the Tour, if it's equaling or bettering the previous best result, is life-changing, career-changing, certainly could be salary-changing. And and the Van Garderen as well, when he was at BMC, did look like he had that pressure on him to be the team leader when perhaps didn't have the personality type for the all of the pressure that goes with it. I don't know. It'd be interesting.
I feel sorry for Van Garderen because, you know, he's a victim of his own precocious success in the sense that he was fifth in the Tour at 24 years of age, and then you create your expectations for yourself and you create expectations on the part of your team and teammates, and you're almost condemned them then to go for GC for the rest of your career, whether it be in the Tour or the Giro or the Vuelta. And a lot of the time with Van Garderen and people, and including members of staff at BMC, for example, have sort of been exasperated because they've looked at his, he's looked very down when things have not been going well. He's sort of internalized his own disappointment, and it's kind of radiated out and created a less than ideal atmosphere in the rest of the team. But would you rather have someone who is disappointed with their own failures and shows that, or would you have someone who doesn't care that he's making his teammates ride on the front all day and then getting dropped 3 kilometers up a big climb and losing a lot of time? And I think that a lot of the time he has been stressed and he has been disappointed because he has expected better of himself. And he's kind of been in the same quandary that Richie Porte has had, whereby people say, well, what two ingredients go into being a good Grand Tour rider? They're time trialing and climbing. And they completely ignore and overlook that there's a whole other component, which is about recovery and focus and just constructing a 3-week race. And that's where he has fallen short. But no, because he's a really good time trialist, he's a really good climber, and people have just expected him to be one of the best in the world. And I think that this stress, as you said, Rich, it's also been channeled into his way of racing. I remember a conversation I had with Bram Tankink, the Lotto Jumbo at the time, rider a couple of years ago, and at the Giro, and he said, he'd never seen someone look so stressed in the peloton as TJ Van Garderen. He was desperately, striving to be on a teammate's wheel throughout the whole stage every day, and you could just see the stress in his face. I don't think that was easy for him, and now he's gone to a team with a completely opposite approach, and we'll see how that works out.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to our great supporters, Science and Sport. A reminder that you, the listener, can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com using the code at the checkout, SISCP25. And we know lots of you take advantage of that, and please continue to do so. Each week, we're also taking a question and putting it to the Science and Sport experts. This week's question comes via a voice memo to our WhatsApp number. That number again, +44 7971 338 205. So you can leave a voice memo with a question or email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And this week's question comes from Germany. We'll hear the question and then we'll hear from Ben Samuels of Science and Sport.
Hello and good morning from Germany. This is Constantine with a question regarding gluten-free nutrition, especially with my problems regarding lactose intolerance and somewhat of an allergic reaction towards almonds. I do feel that living a healthy diet has become increasingly difficult whilst trying and having to avoid gluten as well. So are there any suggestions for recipe books or nutritional ideas on how to live on a lactose-free, gluten-free, and non-almond diet? Thanks, and have a good ride.
Interesting question, Constantine, and with such dietary restrictions, it can seem quite daunting at first. An approach to day-to-day nutrition would be to understand the foods that you can have and which food groups those fit into, and from there you can start to develop your general intake. So foods are often classified by their macronutrient, carbohydrates, proteins and fats being the three big ones. There are then a range of micronutrients that are important in a balanced diet. Suitable carbohydrate options for yourself would include certain varieties of rice, potatoes, quinoa, gluten-free breads, gluten-free pasta. Those can all be used to satisfy your daily energy and carbohydrate requirements. Protein intake can then come from meat, fish, eggs, tofu or soy-based alternatives, and it's important that you get a good protein feeding with every meal. There's then a range of fruits and vegetables that should be included on a day-to-day basis to meet your micronutrient needs, and finally fats from seeds, avocados, different oils, olives and animal products. Overall, it's understanding really what you need, how this breaks down into foods that are suitable for yourself, and piecing them together in a day-to-day plan and really building around that. When it comes to endurance exercise and time on the bike, Science and Sport energy gels, energy powders and hydro tablets are all vegan and therefore suitable for yourself.
So this weekend is Het Nieuwsblad and Kern of Brussels Kern, let's not forget. We're going to hear from Sepp van Mark, who's a former winner at Het Nieuwsblad, in a moment or two. Lionel, you're heading out there. One thing that's caught my eye already, Bora Hansgrohe announced their team yesterday, and it doesn't include Peter Sagan, who usually rides Het Nieuwsblad and is usually up there. And I thought that was interesting. We've talked about Sagan maybe going for Liège-Bastogne-Liège this year, and I wondered if this is part of that effort to just delay his debut in the cobbled classics a little bit, to allow him to maybe extend that or shift the window of form a little bit to include Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So I thought that was quite interesting.
You say, Rich, that he usually rides it. He's kind of alternated. Last year he didn't do this opening weekend. There have been a couple of other years when he hasn't done it, but some when where he has. But as you say, I think it's probably got a lot to do with him wanting to have a pop at Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
I forgot they didn't ride last year. So it was 2 years ago, I think. He was second, third. He was certainly up there in the break with Greg Van Avermaet when he won it.
Yeah, was that the year he arrived at the press conference with hairy... He'd raced with hairy legs, hadn't he? The race
before.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and everyone was wondering whether he'd shave his legs.
Mm.
Then he turned up to the start in leg warmers.
Could be right, but Lionel, it could be bathed in warm sunshine, which I was there last year, and it was, I've never been as cold in my life as I was on Sunday morning in Kerna. It was unbelievably cold. This weekend could be very different.
Yeah, well, it's very spring-like, isn't it? 20 plus degrees here in London, slightly sinister.
Well, less than slightly sinister. It's unnerving.
It is unnerving, isn't it? Whether it will affect the racing too much, I don't know. I mean, makes it a lot easier if it's not freezing cold or raining, or clearly.
And for the riders.
Yeah, exactly. The riders as well. It's always interesting. Very reluctant to get involved in any kind of predictions. It's the first opportunity just to see who has got their preparation bit right, where they are now. But we know from history that Omloop Het Nieuwsblad doesn't really tell us a great deal when it comes to the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix.
Nobody's ever won Het Nieuwsblad and Tour of Flanders, have they?
In the same year?
Yeah.
No, pretty sure that's still correct. Yeah.
That's a remarkable statistic.
Well, there's a month between them, isn't there? And there's an extra 60 kilometres in the Tour of Flanders. They're quite different events. I think that's assuming that they're, you know, like for like is, well, it's not. They're not, are they? They're very different races.
No, but they're similar roads and, you know, same part of the world. Anyway, shall we hear from Seth Van Mark, who is a former winner of Het Nieuwsblad, and one of these guys who, I mean, he's finished on the podium Paris-Roubaix as well. He's somebody who I think it's always been felt that at some point in his career he would win Flanders or Roubaix or both, and has not done so yet. And he's had a lot of bad luck over the years, and he's been there or thereabouts, but that big win has eluded him. So he is preparing for another tilt at the classics. He won in the Tour de Haute Var in France, so he's got his season off to a good start. And he's made some changes as well for this year. Here's what he had to say at the EF Education First training camp in Girona.
Yeah, for the moment I feel good. The plan was to start in Bessèges, and that went well. It was not a really hard race, so that was nice to get into the season. Now I just did Provence, that was a lot harder. I suffered a lot. And that will only be good for the condition for the next months. But I'm happy with my condition now. I'm normally not on my top level yet. Shouldn't be. And so hopefully in the next few weeks and months I'll still get better.
And obviously your major goals this season come early, as always, in the classics. Have you changed your approach to them this year, or do you stick to the same sort of routine, same training, same schedule?
Some things have changed. The biggest change is that I changed coaches the first time since 12 years. I was really happy with the coach I had, like with his way of coaching, and I had some great results also because of him. But it was... the team, like we said before, they changed a lot and became more and more professional. And one of the changes also through performance is that they want to have every rider trained or coached by a coach that is involved in the team. So that was also their request. And of course, I'm part of the team, and I don't want to... Yeah, I don't know how to say it. I don't want to... fight against it or anything. So now I changed coaches, and maybe after 12 years it's maybe a good step also for my career, just to have like some different types of training or different things to do, and maybe my body accepts it very well and I go better. That's what I hope. But of course with a different coach there's a different way of training, and some things have changed. Yeah.
And obviously the classics are your main objective. What would a victory in one of the big classics mean to you?
Oh, that would mean a lot. Yeah, for sure. It's I wouldn't say since I was a child that I was dreaming about that. That's not true, because I never thought I would be professional. I was just cycling and riding my bike because I loved it, and never thought about that I would be able to become a professional rider. But then since my first year, things were going well in the classics, second year, third year also, then I won Omloop at Nieuwsblad. And from then on, you start thinking about the big classics, and that's already a while ago, and I'm still fighting for it. So let's say in the beginning of my professional career, people said like, oh, for sure you're going to win, and you're going to win multiple times and this and that. And after a while, you start to believe it, like, yeah, I'm really close. And but now I'm 30 years old and still didn't win a big classic, and I've always been close. I think every cobbled race I start, I'm with the favorites in the front. I'm one of the favorites, and I've been on many podiums and many top fives, but just winning is hard for me, and so it would be a dream come true now in the end if I would finally win one big race.
Do you ever, does doubt ever creep in that you can win one, or do you always still believe that you can?
I still believe, because it's not that I'm far away from winning. I'm a couple of years ago when Cancellara was on his top level, I was like one of the few guys that could follow him, or when he won the last time Paris-Roubaix, he beat me. When he won the last time Tour of Flanders, I was third. He beat me in the sprint and Van Avermaet. So since then until now, I'm always in the battle for the win. So for sure, if I just, or I need to be a bit stronger, or I need to make right choices. But most of all, I think I just need to have the luck on my side, where there's a gap and they let me go for or they dialed it for a second, and or I have just a super day where I can push a little bit harder, push a little bit longer, and I think the day I stop believing it, then I better stop cycling.
So Sepp van Marck there, one of the favourites for Saturday's Het Nieuwsblad, and you know, looking ahead to the Flanders and Roubaix, would be one of the favourites there as well, you imagine. He has changed coaches. He didn't seem completely happy about that. This is something that, as he mentioned in the interview, a lot of teams are now insisting that, that coaching has, is brought in-house, and that riders aren't working with people who are not directly connected to or employed by the his, team.
His old coach, which was a gentleman called Luc Wonté, no relation to Wonté Group Goubert.
glad you cleared that up. Yeah, and he's been with him a long time, so that's quite a big change, you would think, for him. But then a rider like Sepp van Marck, you do feel, and I'm sure the team felt, that it was worth trying something new, because it has looked that he's been in a bit of a rut. I mentioned the bad luck. He has had some unfortunate crashes and punctures and so on when he's looked really strong. He doesn't have many more chances to win one of these big races. And I spoke to his DS, Andreas Clerc, a few weeks ago. He was second at Flanders in 2005, wasn't he, Clerc? He's DS now, EF Education First. And he was talking about just how these races are ridden now often doesn't suit Van Marck, because he's tended to play a bit of a waiting game. And we're seeing now that riders are going out there striking early. I mean, Sagan at Paris-Roubaix last year went with about 55, 60 kilometres to go. Philippe Gilbert, Flanders the year before, about 60 kilometres to go, 70 kilometres to go. It does seem like the selection has been brought forward a bit, and Van Marck, if he's going to win one of these races, might have to get involved a little bit earlier.
I think Van Marck's biggest problem is that whenever he gets to the finish in the final group of whether it's 2, 3, 4 or 5, he tends to not be the quickest. Out-sprinted a lot of times by Cancellara at Paris-Roubaix, by Cancellara and Van Avermaet at Tour of Flanders, by Van Avermaet, Sagan at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad in the past, and you know they're just the ones that are off the top of my head. It's hard. You can be built for these races, but when it comes down to the finish, if you're not alone and the other guy is quicker, it's very hard to win. I know that sounds really obvious and simplistic, but that's the kind of the mould of Sepp van Marck. That's who he is, and so maybe he does need to get involved in the preliminary phase of the end game rather than waiting and waiting and waiting. And I mean, there's nothing new with this kind of, with it kicking off, certainly in the Tour of Flanders, with sort of 60, 70 kilometres to go. I mean, Quickstep a few years back made it almost their signature move. De Volder or Chavanel would go in that first wave, knowing that they had Tom Bonan sitting and waiting. I mean, that, you know, that's the ideal scenario for the team, and it's why Quickstep, now De Koenig Quickstep, have always been so strong in these races, because they've had numbers and they can afford to participate fully in any phase of the race and they can take it on, whereas Van Marck has always been more on his own.
I mentioned opportunities might be running out for him, but I guess he's almost been too strong for his own good, and so it's been very difficult for him to move. His best chances might come as his powers, or as others think that his powers wane, and you know, he may be given license to get him one of these early moves that, like Matt Heyman did a couple of years ago at Paris-Roubaix, but he'll have to alter the way that he approaches these races and his mindset, I think, going into them, which could be the bigger challenge, maybe, who knows.
It's also the question of his team, isn't there? I mean, they should be shaping up fairly well with Langeveld and Finney, who we had an interview with, but we're gonna hear that in a few weeks, aren't we, Rich?
Yeah, Taylor Finney on Paris-Roubaix is.
I mean, that is one different dude.
One for the ages.
I listened to that interview, and strange things are afoot outside the EF education bus, to paraphrase a famous 90s movie.
You went off and... Yeah, I mean, yeah, some interesting thoughts from Taylor Finney on training and visualizing and so on. But that's a few weeks down the tracks. Lionel, who's going to win Het Nieuwsblad?
Oh, Van Avermaet. Van Avermaet. Do you want me to do my top 18? Riders likely to win Om Loop Het Nieuwsblad between now and the end of time? No, I'm not doing that. I think Van Avermaet will win.
Yeah, that's a good shout. He looks good. Any advances on Van Avermaet?
I'm looking forward to finding out.
Michael Valgren, maybe again. He's also looked pretty sharp. Defending champion.
It's a race where people have got on little runs. They're looking back. Van Petegem won in 97 and 98. Stannard won in 2014 and 15. Van Avermaet himself won in 16 and 17. So, yeah, you wouldn't rule out a back-to-back for Michael Valgren. Moved teams, hasn't he? Of course, Dimension Data now from Astana. But maybe he's got his eye on the races a bit later on in the spring. Who knows?
Sure he does. Shall we wrap things up for this week, fellas? We'll be back next week. I think we might have... I can't remember what we've got next week, but... Well, we'll have you from Het Nieuwsblad.
We will.
How could I forget?
I think there might be... I don't want to over-promise and under-deliver here, but I think there'll probably be some form of Friends of the Podcast special episode from opening weekend in Belgium. Hoping to get that online on Monday morning.
Great.
We'll see.
Great. Excellent. Well, thank you very much, and have a good weekend and... Belgium, Lionel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Just before we go, we're starting a new thing this week, actually copying other podcasts, and saying thanks to some of you who have been good enough to sign up as a friend of the podcast. You can become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com, of course, and as well as receiving exclusive episodes for Friends of the Podcast, your support helps us make the podcast and get to races, including all three Grand Tours. To say thanks, we're going to pick some names at random to mention as we play out. So this week, my thanks to Mark Head and Cooper Shanks.
Thanks to Blake Thompson and Simone Bone.
And thank you to Ryan Clark and Lynn Jones.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.